Okay, I am ready. Let's go.
Madam President.
Yeah, what is it?
We've been conferring, and we think it's a mistake for you to go live pigeon shooting.
Why? I'm on vacation. Live pigeon shooting is, like, my favorite thing.
As you know, Norway launched missiles against an American cruise ship.
I know. What is up with Norway? They used to be so chill.
Well, for you to go pigeon shooting clashes with the gravity of the situation, Madam President.
Huh. Well, let's get the whole Secret Service detail together and play tug of war. You know I love tug of war.
I'm afraid tug of war is also out of the question, Madam President.
Well, what can I do? I'm in a pressure cooker 24/7. I need to blow off some steam.
We did some research, Madam President, and we came up with this.
What is that?
It's called Cup and Ball.
Cup and Ball?
It's a 19th century amusement, and it's far more difficult than it looks. The ball is attached to the cup via this long string. The game is to swing the string in such a way that the ball lands in the cup. So, in a way, it resembles golf.
That's your idea of fun?
A pastime, Madam President.
You know what that's going to make me want to do? Shoot pigeons.
So, we're back where we started.
All right, well, let's just think about all this while we listen to the no's. Can presidents play golf when terrible things are happening? Also, can you be a feminist and still enjoy catcalls and wolf whistles? And now he got a construction job just so he could whistle at Blythe Danner, Colin McEnroe.
Well, who knows? She might walk by. She's rehearsing on Margulies' play right now. The last time she passed, I yelled, "You were great in Meet the Fockers," and I think she heard me wrong. So anyway, welcome to the No's special Hello Ladies edition. On the show today, Teresa Kramer is spending part of her birthday with us. She's a founder of The Cut, an online magazine for the young adults of Connecticut who are falling apart right before our eyes. On this one day, construction workers are allowed to yell that she looks good for her age. No longer young, but still beautiful, thanks to nearly constant saline injections. James Hanley, the peerless leader of Trinity Cine Studio. And finally, when he walks down the street in New York, he strides confidently and doesn't wear slutty clothes. But they still treat him like a tramp. Guitar hero, award-winning producer, and cancer activist Jim Chapdelaine with us. Later in the show, we will indeed talk about this New York Post features writer, Dori Luwak. I don't know if I'm saying her name right, who published an op-ed Monday that touted the joys and thrills of getting catcalled, especially by New York's finest construction workers. We'll also be talking about, I don't know how to put this exactly, but sort of a different kind, a new kind of Dr. Feelgood, a plastic surgeon who offers a so-called lunchtime lift, a saline injection that makes your cup runneth over for 24 hours or so. A New York Times article about it this week contained the quote from a disapproving doctor, "Between good bras and chicken cutlets, you can always look good in clothes." I will never look at chicken cutlets the same way again. Presumably, they're not the breaded kind. But for something a little bit more serious, and that's President Obama is now coming under quite a bit of criticism. He's on vacation in Martha's Vineyard. This is a very, very troubled time in the world, and we've had an especially personal tragedy, the story of journalist James Foley, who was beheaded shortly after receiving that news. President Obama headed out on the golf course where he was for many hours, and there he may have even smiled many times and fist-bumped somebody else who had completed some sort of excellent golfing shot. So the question is, you know, is this permitted? Is this something that we should disapprove of? It's a complicated job. It is a pressure cooker job. There are tragedies that happen every day. Some of them are very vivid and personal and intimate and have names. And sometimes it's 30 people who died somewhere and maybe it's a little less clear. But what seems to be happening this time is not only in the kind of 24-hour right-wing news cycle where he's disparaged all the time, but even among people who are ordinarily sympathetic to him, there's sort of a little sense that maybe he did something wrong. And Teresa Kramer, since it's your birthday, you can go first. And also because you are, at least earlier in the day, you were of somewhat divided mind about all this.
Yeah, I was. Part of me thinks, like you said, he's the president. He's got like Cajon said in the opening anyway, it's a tough job. And if the 2 weeks where you get vacation just turn out to be, you know, an international nightmare, you don't get your break like everybody else. But I certainly understand that this seems tactless and a little gross.
Yeah. So, I mean, and you don't get your break anyway. We should be clear about that. When you go on vacation and you're the president of the United States, 200 people come with you.
Yeah.
And yeah, the nuclear football comes with you and everything else. You get daily briefings on domestic and international issues. You still do your weekly radio broadcast. There's a whole bunch of things that you don't get to stop doing anyway. Nancy Reagan said it's not a vacation. It's just a change of scene, which then raises the question, well, then why take it if you're going to be punished for doing it, James? But we know that the Prime Minister of England actually did cancel his vacation over something going on in Syria. So there's an optics here, right? I mean, that's
right.
Part of the issue.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it's a matter of tone. And I just think that maybe there are too many people around him advising him perhaps about what he should do. And like people who see him under tension maybe suggest that he does something that, you know, that he goes ahead and don't break your routine and stuff. But you have to think in terms of tone and the projection of your image. And if you're not – if you're in a position like that where you are on all the time no matter what, I mean, would it really be so bad to wait a day or two, you know, to be able to say, well, you know, I'm going to – going. You know, have, what would pictures of him walking in the woods do, for example, you know, looking like he was affected by this and thinking about this? I think, you know, people around the world are watching this stuff. And doing something like that and having somebody around him who could say to him, look, don't – go out on the golf course, particularly with the echoes of the George W. Bush thing where he, you know, was merrily going out on the golf course after terrorist activity and you know, sort of making out that he was not going to have his routine changed. But the fact is that when things happen of that kind, things do change. You can't say it doesn't change. And so I think that as the president, he should be casting that tone that indicates that, okay, this is a time to be thoughtful and be careful that you don't project the image that you're doing something else.
I wonder if it is partly golf. You know, I mean, I'm sort of serious about that, though. I mean, you know, the only president really who could successfully recreate was JFK, who almost kind of was a symbol to the nation. I mean, I think people sort of – the nation kind of enjoyed the fact that he was there in Hyannis and that they were going out in sailboats and they were playing touch football. And there was this sort of idea of vigor and fun. But for the most part, we don't like it when presidents do these kinds of things. And somebody always has a problem with a vacation. Jerry Ford went to Vail. People were mad that he was skiing during a recession because he was skiing during an inflation period was bad in some way. President Bush, well, we'll even come to that. But, I mean, he certainly took a lot of heat for his vacation. But there's something about golf, too, right? I mean, it bothers
now,
people.
Now watch this shot.
Well, yeah, we actually have that clip if you want to.
So that's
– actually, before you go, we'll play the clip so people know what you're talking about. So 2002, President Bush was talking to the press on the golf course about some deaths. They were Israeli deaths, I believe, 9 people dead in some kind of bus bombing. I think I have that right. And he just made a very, very abrupt transition as he stood there on the golf course. Yeah, you can hear it here.
We must stop the terror. I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you.
Now watch this drive.
All right, that's too abrupt a transition. But there's something about golf; it bothers people, right? There's something inherently.
Maybe it appears elitist or something like that. I don't know. I don't play golf. I've failed miserably every time I try. I tried because of my dad to just tag along with him a bunch of times and would always watch people throw their clubs in the pond and stuff. But I know people who play golf and love it, and they feel like they get a lot accomplished on the course. So, and I'm told that much business happens on a golf course. And perhaps that would explain my station in life.
Right.
It could be worse, though. I mean, it could be like beach volleyball or something like that.
Yeah, right. Or
disc golf. Maybe he needs to take up disc golf.
Right.
Yeah.
So optics is the key thing here, 24-hour news cycles and stuff. So this is an uncharacteristic misstep, I think, for Obama, who's usually sensitive to this. In keeping this in mind, he was at the National Press Conference dinner the night before killing bin Laden. And he was really funny that night. As I recall, his timing was great and he was flying out zingers. And nobody took him to task for that. I mean, he had to be preoccupied with the fact that he was about to change the world. So I feel like this was, yes, a little bit tasteless and probably a handler mistake or ultimately his mistake.
Yeah, and we don't know. I mean, as James suggested, there may have been strategists, I mean, military strategists even saying, go out and play golf. We need you to make it look like
look
nothing's
normal.
Changed.
Look normal.
Yeah, I mean, we need you to do that. Yeah. I mean, we don't know whether that's the case or not. Before I want to go around with one more aspect of this, but I also want to say we won't be on this topic very long. Our number's 860-275-7266 if you wanted to chime in. 860-275-7266. We have other topics we need to get to. But, I'm not sure I entirely agree with one thing that you said, which is that he's usually good at this. You know, I do think that there's this sense of Obama that his emotions aren't exactly in sync with the emotional life of the average American, or at least there's that knock against him.
I think that's second-term Obama.
Yeah, but even first term, there was this.
Well, he's made these sort of like watermark race speeches, and when he gets pressed, he rises to that occasion. And who knows what press means, because the world is just this giant kerfluffle right now. And I would imagine that his inbox is probably fairly full. So I have no idea if this is the moment that he rises to, or this is just another moment where he's like, I got to get out of here.
There's another thing, too, that I think, there's a considerable movement online to have people not watch that video, for example, and to sort of minimize the impact of people who are obviously trying to create an impact. And so I'm sure that that's playing into the whole issue of, you know, how you appear. That we're talking about probably a whole team of advisors who are sort of having a meeting and then deciding this is what you should do. And I think that under these circumstances, emotionally, it seems to me that Obama kind of withdraws himself emotionally and then becomes very sort of businesslike. And it almost seems like the product of a committee at that point. Everybody's decided this is what you should do.
I mean, that's a thought that I had anyway, that there are differences between Obama and certain other presidents. Clinton, we always knew that Clinton's emotional displays were sort of displays, but we kind of liked that anyway because he was so good at it. I don't know.
Well, I'm sitting here thinking that when you're the president, it's got to be hard to strike the right tone, because you cannot like most people who would see this video would probably just cry and crawl under the bed or something. But you're the president and you can't do that. So you have to be appropriately, you have to be stern. You have to be somehow warm and comforting for the family. You have to be all these things that it's almost impossible to be when you can't show any true emotion, because you're the president and you don't get to just sob on television.
Yeah. All right. We got a call here from our number, by the way, 860-275-7266. Kristen in Storrs. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Colin.
You're on the air.
I'm just wondering if you have any statistics at your fingertips about how many days Obama's taken on vacation compared to previous presidents. It seems like he never takes vacation other than 2 weeks in August and 2 weeks at Christmas.
Yeah, he has not. He's taken far less. I think he's taken about 150 days of vacation during his entire two terms so far here, as contrasted to, I mean, President Bush, the second President Bush, kind of famously took a lot of vacation. Now, some of that involved just moving his operation to his ranch in Crawford and mountain biking and doing stuff like that. I think he had over
clearing brush.
Right. He had a lot of brush. He was having brush actually airlifted in because he had cleared so much.
I'm out of brush.
So it just didn't even look that much like a vacation, but whatever you call it, I think there were more than 800 days of that during his presidency. So, yeah, Obama doesn't take a lot of vacation. And as we say, it doesn't really seem to matter that much anyway when you're on vacation. This seems to me more like strategy. But it also does seem like it's a little bit of a reaction to, like, who is this guy and how does he process his emotions?
And is that lens even more amplified now than it was during the time that Bush was president? Which was even a more chaotic time. So it is. I do think it was a misstep on his part. I think it's over with already, because there's far more pressing issues.
But I think you have to factor in the immediacy actually of things now. That, like we were talking about Kennedy, you know, how Kennedy appeared to be sort of carefree on his boat and stuff like that. I think the immediacy of people finding out about stuff now is so great that there's this tremendous pressure to have reactions to everything immediately. And it means that you've got to gather everybody together and decide where are you going to go with this. And so it's a very different paradigm from what it might have been like even 20 years ago.
Or FDR sort of camouflaging his own the fact that he was in a wheelchair.
Yeah, well, that couldn't happen.
I think there's also kind of a false set of assumptions or pretenses, a kind of kabuki about what our emotional behaviors really are. And I think back to some other instances. For example, I believe Clinton was caught laughing walking out of Ron Brown's funeral. I'm pulling this out of my memory, but I think I have it right, that he was seen laughing at some point during Ron Brown's funeral. I remember there were some congressmen right after 9/11 who got in trouble because they were caught or they were photographed in a bar where they were laughing, you know, within a day or two of 9/11. But the thing, Teresa, that strikes me about that is we all know that often at times of tragedy, at times of grief, at times those are often times when we do laugh. Human beings are not uniformly serious at these times. Sometimes in the almost most horrible of situations, you find something to laugh at.
At my grandfather's funeral, you know, people come up to you and they're constantly saying, you know, I'm so sorry, blah, blah, blah. And that just sort of makes you want to cry more. Mm. And so my friend Lindsay and her mother started just whispering really dirty, horrible things in my ear so that I would just laugh. And every time someone would come up and say something that just made me want to cry, they would tell me I was some horrible, terrible, awful thing. And I would start laughing.
And that's
instead.
It's not presidential either.
But she's not president. There's a million stories exactly like that because humans need to whistle by the boneyard. And so I don't think this is quite whistling by the boneyard. No. I think it's just a miscalculation and that there are amplified optics that are increasing exponentially all the time.
Instantly.
Right. And the news cycle that was once 24 hours is now down to about 12 seconds.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's grab one more call here, and then since we've decided we're going to try to do three topics in the B segment, we may have to move on here pretty quickly. Here's Jim in Oakville. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. I think you might need to turn your radio down, though, because it'll mess with your brain if you don't.
I'll turn my radio down.
All right.
I'm just saying that I don't see anything wrong with President Obama going on the golf course at the time of a tragedy. He needs to process his emotions. I think of Winston Churchill during the whole of the Second World War had his cigars and he had his alcohol, his wine and his port. This man neither drinks nor smokes. He just does golf. I don't see any harm in it.
All right.
And
that's a good point.
He can pretend that the golf ball is a terrorist or something, and it would help him gain objectivity.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for that call. I think he's
on Nicorette, though.
Yeah.
He brewed his own beer.
I don't think he's a teetotaler anyway.
No.
And we do think he quit smoking, but, you know, people are sneaky. All right. So there are some things that cameras never do catch.
Right.
All right. So we're going to take a little break here. We've got so many more things that we want to talk about today. So we'll do that. We'll come back.
Bermuda shorts, we're golfing in paradise. We're golfing in paradise. Even bad shots look so nice when you're golfing in, when you're golfing in, when you're golfing in paradise. When you're golfing in paradise.
Very jazzy. All right. So it's the nose today. It's Teresa Kramer's birthday. So she got to pick one of the topics. We would have let her pick the topic anyway, but we'll make it look like it's a birthday present. Mm-hmm. Because in the minute we suggested doing the nose, she said, yes, but I have to talk about this. And so this is a piece that ran earlier this week. Dori Luak, a features writer for The New York Post, published an op-ed that went up on Monday night in which she basically said that she kind of enjoys – it's a little pick-me-up for her if she's walking along a New York Street and some of the ever-present construction workers yell out some words of praise or whistle at her. I mean, she doesn't want to be called any particular filthy name or anything like that, or she doesn't want anybody getting too graphic. But she says the mystique and the machismo of manly construction workers have always made my heart beat a little faster. Wait a minute, though. I actually wrote that. That's not I'm not reading from everybody's. It made me sashay a little saucier. It's as primal as it gets, ladies. They either grunt in recognition or they go back to their coffee break. It's not brain science. When a total stranger notices you, it's validating. So I'm assuming you disagree.
There's so many – what bothers me is that there's just so many things wrong with her art. Like, I don't know how it got by her editor somewhere should be crying into his coffee because, it makes no sort
Why
of intellectual sense.
Yeah,
because no lady would have let that out. So one, like if you're a guy, you may not know that there's sort of an undercurrent in like the ladies' internet of discussions of street harassment and catcalling in general because – I mean, for years and months and whatever, people have been talking about this. And then she comes out and is like, no, it's wonderful. And she makes no connection between the things she's saying are bad, like people being really rude and disgusting to you in your face, and how the call from the distance that's just like, hey, lady, looking good, is really just the same thing on a continuum. Once you allow one, it just ends up at the other end. And she doesn't really address that at all. But she also makes it very clear that she goes out seeking this attention, that she's like, I need someone to yell at me today, so I'm going to put on a short skirt. Yeah, I'm going to walk by the construction, which makes no sense to me because those guys will yell at anything. Like, it's not personal to you. It's not that you really look that great. It's that they're standing around and have nothing to do and they're just going to yell at you.
Although she does say she's learned that it's not what you wear, the skimpy sundresses, the sky-high heels, but how. Walking confidently past a mass of men, making eye contact and flashing a smile shows you that you have really bad judgment.
Whoa.
It shows you that you are.
I'm open to your harassment.
You're
right, what right. That says.
Yeah, do it.
Yeah. You're self-possessed and playful, it says.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think that she's confusing the personal, which is it's her personal kick, you know, that she likes to do this, and sort of extending it by writing about it like this as though everybody should accept it that way.
Yeah,
and
all those ladies at Vassar who are shaking their finger at her. She's very upset about. Yeah,
exactly. And that's sort of like a tiresome sort of attempt at sort of making it. It eventually, of course, licenses all of the bad things and all of the bad implications of what's going on. When it's really just her particular kick, her particular kink that she likes to.
So you're saying it's a fetish for her.
It's a fetish for her, but then she's writing this thing and then making out that, okay, other women should feel that way. It's normal.
Yeah,
you shouldn't worry about it. But, of course, when it turns nasty, what are you going to do then? You're validating that people can act this way, that men could act this way towards women?
Yeah, she didn't point out that all those men were dressed in latex. and that's the only way it's okay.
Yeah.
No, it's also sort of this weird stratification of mating rituals that she's validating this caveman Neanderthal behavior.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Where's the clubs? And
she probably actually goes out on dates with the guys who honk at her as she's walking down the street. Yeah.
My number is. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, this woman, who knows what her personal life is like, but it is a really weird signal to send to anyone with a daughter or anyone who knows a woman.
Yeah.
So, and I think most of us do.
That's most people. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I had a couple of reactions to it. I mean, one of them is it's such a uniquely New York paradigm. I mean, including the fact that there's a lot of construction going on. I was just in New York for 3 days and I was in Chelsea where basically everything is under construction. I mean, they build new buildings and just rip them down and build other new buildings that harmonize better with the High Line or something. So there's just constant – I mean, you could walk around in Hartford and wait a long time for any construction work. This is sort of a New York – and even that thing is kind of a New York thing.
Yeah,
actually,
it is sort of.
Back,
yeah.
Back in the 80s, I took my one stab at covering the actual runway shows, the high fashion runway shows for one season. And I had this incredible experience where I can't remember whose house it is, but in somebody's showroom, one of the high fashion showrooms, actually has sort of a bay window, or back in those days did, that looked right out onto the street. And so when they did an afternoon show with these runway models, they were walking right towards that bay window. And I happened to notice from my seat at the show that construction workers on their lunch break with their slices of pizza and stuff like that had come over to this bay window to watch all the runway models. So I went outside and wrote down everything that they said. And it's such an incredible clash of those ice cold runway models who never smile, who, as Whoopi Goldberg once said, you know, they're making, you know, $20,000 an hour and they still look like they're pissed off.
Right.
And these guys, these merry, you know, these rude mechanicals, these Shakespearean, you know, buffoons who are, you know, commenting, but not really, not in a real aggressive or hostile way, but in just sort of the way that they do.
That's my real problem with her article is that she makes no connection to that just can become something else because it is a very New York thing. But part of that is the street life of New York is there's just more people because, you know, I was thinking about this and, you know, I was talking to a male friend who says his wife, they live in Hebron. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's like no people. It's just cows and them.
Well, so those are actual cat calls.
Yeah. The wolf whistles come from real wolves. Yeah,
but she's a runner and people honk, yell, whatever, as she's – and I mean that is scary when you're out somewhere in the middle of nowhere by yourself and men are yelling at you from a car. That's terrifying.
That's very scary. Yeah, it's bad.
And any one person sort of egging them on and giving them a reason to continue to do this.
It's like making the impression that it's just guys. You know, don't worry. Yeah. You know, it's benign. And ultimately, it does deliver the different message.
You know, in Amsterdam, they have a solution to those windows.
They put a red light in them? Yeah.
Which is all by itself such an incredibly – I mean, there are so many people walking through the red light district for no other purpose than to look at these poor women.
Just to gawk.
Who are, you know, probably Eastern European women who didn't really expect to be there 6 months ago and are now being displayed as wares. I mean, that's to me as weird and cringeworthy as it gets, actually.
And that's the basis of a really lucrative tourist trade.
Right. For
that,
people
that's
who – yes.
Actually
I mean, there's
what
two
they're basing it on.
Right.
Well, it's not quite like Bangkok or something like that. I think it's – they have it – I think they have a union. I'm not sure. I was told by a Dutch person that it's just part of their economy.
Yeah, it's kind of systematizing it and making it part as though it's okay to do it that way. Yeah.
Well, one question you might have is, well, let's say that I really do want to get wolf whistles and I really do want to get cat calls. Is there anything I could do to sort of enhance that possibility short term? Well, according to another article in the New York Times this week, in fact, there is. Before a romantic Caribbean weekend with her new boyfriend, Amanda Sanders decided she needed a little lift. She called her doctor, Dr. Norman M. Rowe, whose phone apparently is ringing off the hook these days. He's a plastic surgeon in Manhattan. He offers a quick fix, temporary breast enlargement. Instead of surgery, he injects saline solution into the breasts, which briefly expands them. The procedure began as a way for women seeking breast enhancement to determine how they might look if they chose surgery. That's how it began. But it's turned into something else now. It basically is something that – well, it says it may not surprise that the injections were soon being requested as pick-me-ups for parties, weddings, bar mitzvahs, red carpet events, or as with Ms. Sanders, a tropical vacation. You know, because she wanted to wear string bikinis and halter tops and stuff like that and just look really great. So I don't know, James, do you want to take us down any –
Well, it would seem to me if nothing else, it's kind of a troublesome start to a relationship if that's what you're – you know, I mean you go on vacation, the tropical vacations.
You seem different than yesterday.
Right. You've changed.
Yes. But it seems to be changing as we speak.
Right.
It is a little bit like the Wonder Bra, you know, in the sense that if the Wonder Bra really worked its magic in certain ways, sooner or later you'd have to take it off and you really didn't want the man saying, would you mind putting that back on?
I'm confused.
And aren't you going to attract the very sort of person that you probably – well, I don't know. Maybe that is what she wants.
You're
going to
attract a construction worker from
but,
New York.
But somebody who's not going to exactly sort of appreciate you when the effects are gone and you'd be probably in a state of sort of – great dissatisfaction. And I don't know, maybe this is a way of the plastic surgeons drumming up business, you know, because there'll be such disappointment when the saline solution is absorbed and everything's gone back to normal. Oh, well, I'll come back and, you know, get the real thing kind of thing.
It's quite an investment.
It's $3,500.
Yeah, $3,500 for what?
For
one day?
Yeah,
I feel like a breast implant job is only like $10,000.
Right,
so
right.
Why wouldn't you
just
save up a
discount.
Little more? Yeah.
Actually, it's now time to tell Teresa that for her birthday, we all chipped in.
Yeah. Should we do the wolf whistle version of Happy Birthday now, too?
And you know, in fairness, there are all sorts of other body parts that could be enhanced as
sure,
well.
Sure, but this seems like very much like a 1% kind of thing. Yeah.
Do you know anybody?
Well, I have a list.
I'm Irish. This is a very pressing question.
Check out these earlobes.
I also don't understand how the saline solution stays in place. Like, I don't see why it just doesn't.
It goes away.
Immediately, why doesn't it just go away? Like, why doesn't it just disperse throughout your body as soon as it's injected?
Well, you have 20 minutes to look.
I really have to go right now.
So take my picture quick.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do think that what it does – I mean, not to put too sort of futuristic a cap on this, but what it does foretell is a future that's fairly immediate, in which I do feel – you know, that as transhumanism becomes more and more a thing, you'll be able to try certain things on, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, this won't be confined to saline solution. Within the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, you may be able to change certain aspects of your body and change them back out again. I don't know whether that's a good thing or not, but anything you're unhappy with.
I can see the new passport photo rules
yeah,
being written.
Right. Yeah, right. Just the head, please.
Yes.
All right. We have – well, I guess we should probably shift gears here, although people are calling in. 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266.
I wonder if anyone's had it.
I know.
Your,
some
your
lady
listeners.
From Greenwich is calling us right now.
Right, exactly. Oh, yeah. yeah, no, if you've got $3,500 for that, mm-hmm. I'd like to sell you a car. Yeah. All right. So I feel a little – we are going to change gears here, and I feel – I almost disqualified this topic because I kind of feel bad for this person. And I've decided I'm not going to mention his name because I mean, he is from Connecticut and I think he might be living in Connecticut.
Was he actually from Connecticut?
I think he's a Stanford man. Yes, he's a Stanford man. I feel kind of bad for him because this is the kind of story.
He can't hear us.
Back to something James was saying back in the – we were talking about the Obama thing. You know, just things become public now that never would have become public, I think. And I'm not sure in a less digitally rich age, you know, whether this story would have seeped out. Maybe it would. It's the kind of story that people like to tell. But this is the story of a man who found himself in a relationship, not just a relationship, but a relationship that was headed towards marriage. He was planning a wedding that was going to take place in Connecticut. The bride-to-be had spent money on a dress, on invitations, and even on some air flights. And then it all changed. She got a call from a man who said that he was the father of the groom. And that the father of the groom had told her that the groom had thrown himself in front of a car, which
– That should have been the danger signal.
Yeah.
He has a broken leg.
Which, turns out to be
– Dad, could you make a call for me?
So this man basically faked his own death to get out of his wedding. And there is – this story has gone kind of viral. There is something See, I think there's something universal about it. I think we've all been there somehow.
But he's taken it pretty much as far as you could take it without, like, he moved to Mars and legitimizing that. So I will say that back when I was a younger man, for a variety of reasons, I was not particularly adept at entering or exiting relationships and would just sort of ease my way up. I don't think – I think, you know, we were talking earlier, you may have – wanted to be dead, but you didn't actually fake your own death to get out of that. But I do remember very concocted schemes that people would have to sort of avoid that conversation that I guess actual real adults are capable of having. But I'm curious, how do you get your dad involved in this? I mean –
It wasn't his real dad
because the mom was confused. That's how the whole thing got outed is she called the mom and wanted to talk about it. And she's like, what are you talking about? He's sitting over there.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure it was like his friend Joe or something.
Yeah. Or him. He may have just sort of said, you know.
But I mean, wouldn't she recognize the dad's voice? I mean, she's about to marry him, right?
I mean,
well,
I
got the sense it was very whirlwind. I don't think – I think that was part of the whole problem is that she was – they dated for a little while. She was leaving to go back to England, and he was like, well, marry me. And so she met the parents, but I didn't get the sense that they were.
That's what it sounded like. Yeah. I can understand wanting to get out of a relationship and all of that, but it seems that a lot of these things are calling for, say, classes in judgment. It's kind of like classes in tone, sort of like understanding, quote unquote, the new digital age, that things are going to appear differently. And like everybody's going to know about these things really quickly. So maybe you'd better like have an idea of where your particular act is going to end up and what it's going to look like.
So if John Adams had wanted to break up with Abigail,
exactly.
he probably could have faked his own death and it would have been a little bit – a longer time before she figured out.
But that sort of discounts any responsibility he has in this by saying like – the only reason he should be concerned is because we're all going to find out about it. Mm-hmm. But it was sort of, it does leave a mark on this woman, right? This poor woman is left with like, God, this guy was willing to fake his own death to not be with me.
Mm-hmm. I want what's mine, which is out of this. Yeah. And so I can do anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I do think that just to come back to this, there is something universal about it. I mean, or maybe it's universal just among the people who are a little bit more passive and a little
and don't want to make that call.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who don't want to make that call. I don't know if I've ever fantasized about faking my own death to get out of a relationship. I think I have fantasized about dying to get out of a relationship. So faking your own death seems like a step in the right direction from there. But I do think it's the kind of thing that you fantasize about. If you're basically a nice person.
And you don't want to make the call.
Yeah, you don't want to make the call. You don't want to be that person who calls up and says, I don't want to marry you anymore. There's obviously something a little chicken-hearted about that.
but think about it a little longer and not jumping in front of the car.
Yeah.
Conversely,
if you're really skilled at this, what does that say? You're really good at making this call.
Well, that's what I was saying you're saying good at
making
the call.
So if you're really good at, hey, babe,
I
don't want to marry you. I'll see you Friday for lunch. Bye. You're that guy, that doesn't speak to your character either, right?
Well, I think part of the problem here is that there was a wedding being planned. That at some point, to call off the wedding, you are not just breaking up with someone. You are angering families. You are getting deposits taken from you. There's all sorts of things. And so he went instead of where he might have just stopped answering her texts if they were just dating, he was like, I got to fake my own death instead.
Right.
Yeah. It's the only acceptable reason to call off a wedding.
And that would have been the end.
Right. I do think James is right. If in this day and age, in 2014, you can't just on a whim fake your own death and do it with one phone call. It takes a lot
Facebook
of work.
Your Facebook page is still active.
Yeah. It takes right. much more work. I think it's kind of sad that you can't fake your own
death
anymore.
Where are those tweets coming from?
All right. We've got one caller here who wants to go back to the previous topic here. And we even, I think, had a construction worker on the line for a second. I wish he hadn't hung up. I want to hear from that person. But here's somebody who wants to go. That would be two topics jumping back. This is Dave from Waterbury with one topic jumping back. Hi, Dave.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
So I just wanted to point out that skin body tissue is not completely elastic, and if you do this saline procedure more than a couple times, you might not be happy with the end result.
Ooh.
Yeah, that point was made by another plastic surgeon in the New York Times article that, in fact, the structure of the breast could – I mean, you just can't do it the way you change hats or scarves.
Are you a plastic surgeon?
No, I'm just an observer.
Yeah. But that's fine with
aren't
us.
Aren't we all?
It's not an accessory. You can't accessorize that way. You have to sort of take
consequences.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I mean, the main reason that this ever existed in the first place, supposedly, was the more benign reason of how would you like to see anyway what you would look like if you actually did have this permanent procedure. So presumably you only did it once.
You would think that would be an investment made on the doctor's part to entice a client to do this, right?
Photoshop.
$3,500. It's saline. You could make that in your kitchen.
Right. All right. So I'm going to leave a lot of time for endorsements. But if anybody also needs to call up about these other topics, 860-275-7266, we might be able to squeeze a call onto the other side of our break. We'll take that break. We'll come back after this.
My family, they don't worry. They know that I'll land on my feet. And I know why this is. It's because I've got breasts. It's 'cause I got breasts, so I'll get married. I don't need a career when I've got this derriere. 'Cause I got breasts and grow my hair long, and I wear dresses and I'm skinny, I'll be fine.
Ow! A couple things I learned about these 24-hour saline injections. You should get a friend to help you do it. And the Bausch & Lomb contact lens stuff doesn't really work. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Josh Nalea and Britt Hill. Greg Hill appeared in our intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Chris Martin. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff standing on a girder and wolf whistling at Mario Batali, visit our website, WNPR.org. On Monday's show, how a Virginia corruption trial became the portrait of a marriage. And now, back to Colin.
He said, becoming increasingly obsessed with the McDonald corruption trial in Virginia, it kind of It's not your typical corruption trial because they're spending a lot of their time proving, or at least Mr. McDonnell, Governor McDonnell, is spending a lot of time proving that he and his wife were not really connected emotionally while some of this corruption was going on.
I'm waiting for him to actually bring out a bus and toss her under it.
Right. But he's getting – there's something almost a little heartbreaking about the whole story. Well, anyway, we'll come to that. That's coming. So we're going to do endorsements right now. We're going to tell you about things that you might enjoy knowing about. And we'll start with Teresa.
I'm going to endorse Wickham Park in Manchester. I feel like we've got a lot of nice parks in Connecticut, and Elizabeth Park gets a lot of attention in the Hartford area. But I take my dog there quite often to walk, and she has a tendency to bark at other dogs when she sees them because she wants to run up to them and meet them. So going anywhere that's really super crowded and lots of other people can be kind of annoying with her.
Not that I'm stalking you on your birthday, but I did notice a picture of your dog going down a kind of Middle Earth type path. And there was some, I assume that's Wickham Park?
It was not Wickham Park, actually. That's the trail I won't talk about on the radio because I don't want other people going to it.
And whistling.
Yeah,
right.
Is your dog a dingo?
She's an Australian cattle dog, which they were bred from dingoes originally. Yeah.
But Wickham Park, I would second that emotion. Wickham Park's a really beautiful park.
I love it. And there's huge fields and some people don't even know are there. So like she can run around and people don't know. And I take her to the chickens to teach her not to kill them because I would like chickens someday. And it's a great park. And I've been there a lot this summer.
Yeah, it is sort of the Elizabeth Park east of the river. But in some ways, it has a little bit more room to spread out. Even
And it has a lot of stuff going on there. Yeah. They have like the disc golf course and they have one of those fitness trails through the woods, and they have, and there's the aviary, and there's, you know, like a three-legged raccoon or something you can look at. There's,
you know, every time you say disc golf, I keep thinking you're saying disco golf. No. And it connotes a whole different kind of vibe.
All right, Wickham Park has been now been endorsed. James Hanley, what have you got?
The first thing was just an amazing restaurant in Willimantic, Cafe Mantic on Main Street, and I went there with Norman and some friends one evening, and sitting on the terrace at the back, looking out over the railroad and the river, and excellent food. It was just like an amazing experience. We were thinking we were in Berlin or Paris or something like that. It was really, really wonderful, and it's so great to have a place like that that is casual but good and a place you can spend time with people. And if you're a raspberry addict like me, there are fall raspberries coming, and there's this relatively new farm in North Windham called Raspberry Knoll. I think they have a website, raspberryknoll.com, and they have something really amazing, which is a whole field full of raspberry plants, and they also sell flowers by the pound. A really amazing place. And lastly, Man of Iron is one of the Polish films. Tomorrow, Andrzej Wajda's amazing masterpiece about the workers' strike in Gdansk, Poland, that started the cracks in the Soviet Union, actually, in 1980.
And this is part of the Scorsese-curated restoration of these Polish movies that's on display at Trinity Cine Studio right now.
Right, and we're playing that through Thursday. We're playing a different movie at every show, and Man of Iron is tomorrow night's movie, but they're all really been amazing, great films that explain a lot about the state of not just Poland, but Europe and comments on the world. Really amazing.
All right, more endorsements. Jim Chapdelaine.
I would like to endorse this microphone. Wow, I'm used to doing that.
We
on
did
stage,
give him the bad. We gave him the bad microphone today.
I'd say we can. Here, I got this. I got this. I've been amused by Russell Brand and Sean Hannity going back and forth on the internet, but I'm easily amused. But if you are easily amused, this is something that you might want to check out.
You're endorsing a feud, basically.
I basically am, yeah, because it's an amusing feud. It's imbalanced. It's not fair and balanced, but it is amusing.
Can I piggyback an endorsement onto that, too? If you can hunt down the clip of Russell Brand appearing on Morning Joe, where at some point he appears so perplexed by their inadequacies that he asks them if this is really the job that they do.
He really is. He's sort of coming into this new phase of his career that I really like. I thought he was just a silly guy at first, but he's pretty smart.
Well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and so I think Russell Brand is really proving himself.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. That, yes. So, and music-wise, I'm kind of a little bit late to the party, but ex-Fleet Foxes drummer Jay Tillman has a band called Father John Misty that I am really digging. And it's if you like the Fleet Foxes, it's a little more muscular, but it still has those big harmonies, and I really like it a lot.
You can't be late to a musical party on NPR. The audience is divided among the people who don't know about this.
And who already
Didn't know the Fleet Foxes had broken up, never had heard of the Fleet Foxes. We have – there's about a third.
Or else there's a group that's already into Fleet Fox Core.
Right, Fleet Fox
right,
Core.
Right. So and the new Infinity Hall opened up, which I'm very excited about, in downtown Hartford. So that's going to breathe some life, I hope, into downtown Hartford. I'm looking forward to seeing Boyhood tonight, finally. Even though it starts at 6:10. But James may have talked me out of it to wait till September to see it in
yeah.
a proper theater.
You should see it. It's sinister.
But I may see it twice. So, and lastly, at risk of sucking up, Colin's column about Connecticut had me actually laughing very hard today. And I think it bears a short discussion, but everyone should read it. It was very funny. I posted a link to it on Facebook, and it's both pointed and hilarious.
All right. Well, if you have time at the end, maybe we can do a quick discussion because it's very close to the mission of Teresa's magazine. So speaking of Infinity Hall, let me once again – all I'm asking you to do right now is save the date, as they say on those refrigerator magnets for weddings. Save the date of September 30th. That will be the fifth birthday party of the Colin McEnroe Show. We are going to have it at the brand new Infinity Hall in Hartford. You are invited. Everybody who's listening to this is invited. You will be asked to pony up all of $5 for the $1 for every year that we have existed. We have all kinds of special surprises waiting for you, and we think it's going to be a great night. So, and Tuesday nights, you know, you need something to do on Tuesday nights. You don't want to be staying home.
I got Mondays, by the way. I got Mondays.
You got Mondays?
You have Tuesdays.
Tuesdays, yeah, that's right. The Shinola's on Mondays, the Colin McEnroe Show party, at least on Tuesday, September 30th. So do reserve that. Speaking of movies, I couldn't wait to see it at Trinity Cine Studio. I couldn't even wait for it to come to Hartford. But what I'm going to do right now, actually, is endorse Maggie Gyllenhaal in general. She's giving a really interesting performance in this Le Carré-influenced thing on television called The Honorable Woman. It's about the Middle East. It's unbelievable. Current in a lot of ways, in the ways that it explores the tensions between Palestinians and Israelis. And she's just terrific in it. She plays an English woman, and James would be a better judge, but as far as I can tell, rather convincingly. But I also just saw her in this movie that hasn't come here yet. It's called Frank. And if you know, it is. It's hard to find an original movie these days. It's difficult to find a movie that really begins with an original premise and
Guardians
then takes
of the Galaxy.
Guardians of the Galaxy would be the other example. But Frank is really a remarkable movie in which Michael Fassbender plays a musician, a kind of Captain Beefheart kind of figure, a kind of kind of avant-garde rock musician. But what he's really
Michael Fassbender as Captain Beefheart alone
right,
is pretty original.
That's a biopic that's in the works. If I can get funding, but what's unusual about him is that he performs exclusively with this fake huge head that looks like it's made out of either plastic or plaster of Paris or something, which he never takes off. Yeah, it's a trout mask replica, but he never takes it off. So Frank is the story of his band, of the discovery of his band, of a naive British musician who kind of inserts himself into that band and winds up bringing it from the British Isles to the South by Southwest in Austin. But anyway, Maggie Gyllenhaal plays this terminally irritable theremin player, which is funny all by itself and funny in lots
Aren't
of different ways. So this show has not yet come to Hartford yet. I saw it in New York at the beautiful Landmark Sunshine Theaters or Sunshine Landmark Theaters or whatever that place is on Houston Street. But it's a very unusual movie. I'm sure you can make the argument that it drags a little bit towards the end, but it really it's unlike anything I've ever seen, and it's really interesting. I really wanted Jim Chapdelaine to see it because it's a very interesting movie about a band too, and about a band trying to hold itself
and
together.
And I have a theremin.
And you
and
have a
theremin.
You
make
actually own
you so cranky.
Do you actually own a theremin?
I do.
You do.
Yeah,
you would own a theremin, actually.
You
that
have
does,
to.
Does not surprise me. All right. Well, I guess we don't really have time to talk about that column, but I'll sort of second his endorsement of my work, which seems like a horribly egotistical thing to do.
No, it's a very, very good piece.
But just sort of after we did the Wheelhouse on Wednesday, I did notice that so much of this campaign so far, this gubernatorial campaign, seems to hinge on the notion that, you know, Connecticut is a really, really horrible place to live. And it's almost as though both candidates are prepared to acknowledge that about maybe Mr. Foley a little bit more than Mr. Malloy. The question is, like, who made it so horrible and who's capable of fixing it? And I don't really feel like I'm living in this horrible place. And as the founders of the Cut say, Connecticut's sort of like your annoying little sister. You don't mind picking on it, but you don't like it if anybody else does. Mm-hmm. So that's what that column is about. I invite you to hunt it down and append to it a really insulting comment, because that's what everybody else is doing right now.
Vernon, I would have said that one. Avon, Farmington. Yeah.
You want the rain.
Hey, baby, I noticed that you're appearing confident, so I'm cutting you down to make me feel more powerful, yeah.
Well, thank you for saying so.